Aung San Suu Kyi, Myanmar's chief executive and Nobel Peace Prize laureate, spoke to the United Nations yesterday about an issue that has begun to haunt her nation, the long-standing persecution of the Rohingya, a Muslim minority. Some 400,000 Rohingya have braved landmines to flee across the border into Bangladesh ahead of what the UN calls a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. Suu Kyi was expected to condemn the genocide yesterday, but confined herself to generalities and refused to assign blame. Myanmar's armed forces are charged with the oppression of the Rohingya, burning entire villages to the ground and hundreds in recent weeks, according to Human Rights Watch. The questions are raised, is a Nobel Peace laureate presiding over a genocide? Does she have control of her own military? Dr. Grace Chang is an associate professor of political science at Hawaii Pacific University. She's on hand to help us sort out what's going on. Dr. Chang, good morning.
Hi, good morning, Chris.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me here today.
This is a country in which the power of the military is always something to be considered. Is that true?
Yes, that's definitely true. The executive does not have control over the military, so the civilian and the military branch of the government operate distinctly from our system.
They flat out does not have control. That's something that's pretty hard for Americans to understand.
Yeah, you know, that's true. But, you know, in this case, it's really hard to read the situation because, as you said, you know, the Myanmar state counselor, Aung San Suu Kyi, has not spoken out effectively to, you know, assign, you know, the responsibility to the military and other security forces that might be involved in this. You know, it's hard to say what she is intending. Is she afraid of addressing the military directly? But, you know, on the other hand, her office, as well as other branches of the civilian government in Myanmar, they have actively engaged in a lot of the disinformation campaigns that's basically hiding what's happening, you know, denying the reports that are coming out that are various different organizations, including, you know, some of the UN reports, UN groups that have looked into the situation have reported. So, you know, they have been quite aggressive in this as well. Following her speech, which she gave from Myanmar's capital, and she delivered in English, so it was really intended for an international community. You know, many in Myanmar really, you know, praised what she said. There were many people reportedly in the streets who were very happy about, you know, her refusal to really acknowledge some of the information and the international attention given to this issue. So there's a larger kind of political phenomenon going on here in Myanmar, which is really in denial, or, you know, just don't really believe that the Rohingya are citizens of the country.
And clearly, as you said, there was her speech was warmly received by her people, at least her Buddhist population back home.
Yes.
But it also indicates that that population is entirely happy with what has been described by objective observers as a genocide.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is the case. So, you know, that's an indication of some of these trends that are going on in the politics in that country, which are turning very much towards this kind of a Buddhist nationalism, a nationalism that's really based on, you know, the identity that true Buddhists, true citizens of Myanmar are Buddhists. So it's kind of been building up, you know, it's been building up over the decades, but it seems it's particularly intense in the last few years since 2012, when this you know, most recent wave of anti-Muslim attacks all over the country, not just in the Rakhine State, has been taking place.
Well, you know, if a true Myanmar citizen is a Buddhist, it also implies that a true Buddhist citizen of Myanmar is entirely happy to let the massacre of a Muslim population continue. How did all this? You know, this makes me think of the Indian partition in 48, where, you know, half the country tried to kill the other half. I mean, is it Where does all this, hostility to murderous hostility come from?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, a lot of the reports have it that, you know, the military security forces had handed out weapons to, the Buddhist or another non-Muslim residents in the Rakhine State to go and attack, you know, the Rohingya. And some of this intense anti-Muslim, but this very, radical Buddhist nationalism, it has its roots going back probably to the 30s, and this rooted in the idea that, as a result, especially of colonialism, many members of the Buddhist monkhood felt that the Buddhism was under attack, was being threatened by the British presence, who brought in, missionaries and also workers, from other parts of Asia to work in the colonial projects. So this kind of really has been building up over several decades and has recently, transpired. After 2012, one of these Buddhist nationalist monks, Uratu, who's a leader in one of the Buddhist movements, he got out of jail, and it seems to coincide with the violence that took place after that.
You have to wonder what, Aung San Suu Kyi yesterday did not really give us much of an indication of where her heart is. At least it struck me that the speech was very general in tone, and you have to wonder, as she refuses to assign blame, why would you refuse to assign blame, and B, how can someone who's been looked at as a kind of avatar of peace look the other way on clear evidence of mass murder?
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that she sort of is continuing to do. She did recognize and state that she was sorry that there were Muslims fleeing from the country, but she did sort of suggest, and she has in the past, that there the situation there is very complex and that there may be many sides to blame, whereas the outcome of whatever is happening and the military has blocked any access to the areas to really know, but from what we know from reports from people who have fled the area and for groups working in the area, most of the victims are innocent civilians. I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of them who have fled and who suffered great violence on themselves, their families, who've been killed or raped.
Yeah.
So the refusal to kind of acknowledge the disproportionality of the situation and that this crisis is really bearing on one particular ethnic group in something that looks like, if not genocide, then ethnic cleansing.
Well, I mean, that's a pretty fine distinction to be made. Murder is murder, right?
Right. Yes, I don't think that satisfies. That distinction is really kind of just technical.
Yeah. The other thing that has often been said about Burma, we referred earlier to the position of the military in the government. And as you said, it operates unchecked in that country. I'm thinking of a very brief experience in that part of the world that I had 40 years ago, in which the northern part of then Burma was described as more or less a lawless part of the country, devoted in large part to growing opium, which had a huge part of a kind of underground economy in Southeast Asia. Is that still part of what's going on in Myanmar?
I don't know so much about if that's really going on. I think there's definitely, as far as economic interest by international actors, there's definitely, since the country's opened up, it's been attractive. It is a land of that's rich in natural resources.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's something that reportedly the military has really cashed in on, as far as they control a lot of the land. A lot of the areas, for example, in the eastern part of the country where there were conflicts with other ethnic groups, some of the land has been claimed or taken over by the military. So, I mean, the displacements definitely provide some economic gains for some parties.
For some, but, it's always ironic when you hear of a country that's rich in natural resources and is somehow manages to be a poor country.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't seem to have really trickled down to all the people who could benefit from the profits being made. You know, and you're talking about the military. So one of the developments, you know, that coming out of this UN gathering that began yesterday is, you know, the U.S. State Department has promised $35 million in humanitarian aid for the Rohingya refugees. And also Vice President Pence addressed the Security Council and you know, stated that the international community should take strong and swift action to end this crisis. And at the same time, the U.K. suspended aid to the military as well as training. So there's definitely a lot of momentum to put, like, real, concrete, you know, consequences onto the Myanmar state, whether it's the civilian government or the military, to get them to be more forthright with helping to address this crisis.
I have to wonder whose pockets that $35 million is going to end up in.
Well, you know, it's $35 million is humanitarian for the Rohingya, so hopefully that will go to those who are over in Bangladesh. But there are, you know, which are many. There are apparently over 800,000 in Bangladesh from various waves of violence against Rohingya. But there are also, you know, some internally displaced Rohingya within the Rakhine states, although reports did show that a good number of those detention areas where they were held were also burned. So
hard to imagine what life is like in a so-called detention area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Dr. Cheng, thank you very much for talking with us, and I hope we get an opportunity in future to check in, because this is a pretty fluid situation we're seeing. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Grace Cheng is an associate professor of political science at Hawaii Pacific University, specializing in Asian politics, and she has written as well on nationalism and conflict in Asia.
On the next Fresh Air, a Harvard professor reflects on the life and tragic death of her younger cousin. Danielle Allen's cousin Michael was arrested for the first time at 15 when tough sentencing laws were driven by the war on drugs. He spent 11 years in prison and was shot to death 3 years after his release. Allen's new memoir is also a critique of the justice system. Join us.
Hear Fresh Air this afternoon at 3.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, looking at the future viability of oil refining in Hawaii. But first, your quiz. In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about a literary giant who passed through Hawaii in his wild younger days and crafted a masterpiece from the colorful stories he heard here. Herman Melville's greatest work, of course, was his 1851 novel Moby Dick or the Whale, a work rich in details of the whaling life. Melville came by these details honestly. He had been a whaling man himself. His novel was based on the true story of a famous shipwreck that took place in 1820 in waters 800 miles southeast of Hawaii. An 85-foot whale rammed a whaling ship, swam under her, and then squared off and charged her again. As one crew member recalled, quote, "I turned around and saw him about 100 rods directly ahead of us, coming down with twice his ordinary speed of around 24 knots, and it appeared with tenfold fury and vengeance in his aspect." The whaling ship was swamped, crew members survived only after a lengthy ordeal in an open boat, and the ship passed into legend. This morning, we're looking for its name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
Hawaii today is as dependent on oil imports as it ever was, but it's moving away from fossil fuels. And although the state has a long way to go to meet its goal of energy self-sufficiency, today's oil refineries and fossil fuel providers operate in a very different climate than a decade ago. Change is clearly in the air. Jim Yates is the president of Par Hawaii, which operates the state's largest refinery with a rated capacity of 94,000 barrels a day. We asked him for his take on his industry's long-term future.
We're fortunate, I think, with our refinery here. We have a refinery that has been designed to be very flexible in the types of crude it can run, and that combined with the fact that we sit in the middle of the Pacific allows us to really source our crude globally. Mm-hmm. And so we're on the world market. We can run a variety of crudes. Since our ownership of this refinery, we've probably run close to 20 different crudes.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those from North America, Alaska. So far this year, probably 30% of what we have run has come from North America. The other 70% has been sourced relatively equally between the Middle East, Asia, and Africa. But in any given year, last year, for instance, probably in excess of 40% of our crude came from North America.
When you talk about different types of crude, what does that mean, for different purposes?
Yeah, it's interesting. So every type of crude, depending upon what field it's coming from and where it's produced, has different characteristics that will impact its value in the market, so what you have to pay for it, as well as the types of products and amount of those types of products that will be made from it. So crudes are not all the same. They each have a different flavor, as some would call it,
mm-hmm.
and each can have a different yield of valuable products.
I mean, that's one of many things. I'm sure the public doesn't know that much about. The other thing I was thinking about, I just want to go back to what you're talking about in terms of our location in Hawaii, because usually, frequently, let me put it that way, you hear Hawaii's geography talked of as a disadvantage, you know, isolated in the middle of the Pacific. But you're looking at it as a hub and obviously using it as a hub to different parts of the world, you know, as a pivot point, yeah?
That's correct. I mean, there's certainly an element of being isolated out here. We obviously don't have indigenous sources of crude here in Hawaii, and so there is a cost associated with sourcing it and bringing it here that wouldn't be the same if we were sitting in the middle of a crude-producing region.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, we're located in a way that in a place where we're not dependent upon any single source of crude, and so we can access it from virtually any place in the world, which I think provides a degree of resiliency in the event of natural disasters or that sort of thing.
You do hear Hawaii spoken of as vulnerable in terms of delivery systems. Were they to break down, then we would be isolated in the middle of the Pacific, yeah?
Well, that's true. In the sense of any major natural disaster that were to strike Hawaii, dependent upon the specifics of it, it could cut us off from the world for a period of time as we recover, and that's, of course, what every, I guess, island faces, a risk that we all have to deal with, whether it's energy supplies or food supplies or toilet paper.
Sure. Well, how do you hedge against that?
Well, again, I think it starts with the multiple sources of supply, which takes away sort of one vulnerability.
Right.
The other is we have storage, so we have a large storage facility, and I'd say at any given time, of course, this swings and it depends on the product you're talking about, but we probably have 15 to 30 days of supply in storage, and we have 8 different terminals. So we have our refinery, but we also have remote terminals on all the different islands, which kind of spreads the risk a bit as to where product is stored.
Is it possible to get any kind of a time estimate on how long our supply would last in such an event?
It depends again on the product, but as I say, I think the refineries probably are in the 15 to 30 days worth of supply. As I understand it, the utilities typically hold 30 to 45 days mm-hmm. of supply. Mm-hmm. So it depends on the particular top or product that you're speaking of.
Well, let's hope we don't have to consider that any further, you know. But
I think that's right. I think the most important thing in the event of one of those disasters would be how quickly the state working together could recover the critical infrastructure to get product in here. So harbors would be obviously one of the biggest things that would need to be focused on first.
Sure. Thinking long term for your industry, how do you, clearly we all need gas in the car today, but every projection of the future 20, 30 years from now means a lot fewer cars pulling up to the pump, right? How do you and your industry plan long term for that eventuality?
To some extent, the definition of long term plays into that, the answer to that question a lot, because I think we've sort of learned in our industry that long term is something like 5 years, which typically isn't how you think about long term. But the technology and the world is changing so fast, and there's lots of examples just in the last few years of that happening, of how quickly things can shift. It was less than a decade ago, 2008 to be exact, when the price of oil was $147 a barrel that summer of 2008, with projections that would have said by now we would have been in excess of $200 a barrel.
Mm-hmm.
And that drove a lot of decisions with regard to renewables and alternatives and production. And now we're sitting here 9 years later, and it's $50 a barrel. So the world changed so quickly, but we in our industry we look out about 5 years and make our decisions really in a time frame that looks like that. We believe obviously the demand for our product here in Hawaii is going to continue during that period. It's growing in some areas. Well, a big part of our production is devoted to the tourism industry, and so jet fuel is one of our major products,
mm-hmm.
and that has continued to grow in demand. And we don't see a lot of solar powered jets coming around the corner anytime soon.
No, a battery-powered jet, it's hard to imagine. So it's a matter of kind of shifting your resources to where they will continue to be needed decades down the line is what it sounds like.
That's exactly right. The other element I would point out is we're not an integrated oil company, so we don't own the crude in the ground. And as such, we're a little agnostic as to what the feedstock is. So we're actively working with potential producers and entrepreneurs to look for alternative sources, renewable sources of feedstock that could replace oil in our refining process, still produce a liquid fuel that could be used in our systems but might come from renewable sources. So, we try to follow, be aware of, and plugged into what the state's objectives are, and then sort of evolve and amend our operations to fit that.
Jim Yates is the president of Par Hawaii, which operates one of Hawaii's 2 oil refineries in West Oahu.
What's your view on tourism? It's the top industry in the state, a huge source of tax revenue. About 20 years ago, nearly two-thirds of people agreed that tourism has been mostly positive for me and my family. Now that's down to 40%. What's your view? Call our talkback line at 792-8217 and let us know. We'll share some of your thoughts this week on The Conversation.
We're getting into fall and the holidays, and you know what that means.
It gives you this warm, nostalgic, and kind of loving feeling that a lot of companies want you to feel that when you think of their products, of course.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. How a certain flavor that shall not be named came to dominate the autumn. That's next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6, right after All Things Considered.
This week, the Hawaii Tourism Authority is hosting its annual Global Tourism Summit. HPR is taking a closer look at the state of the industry in a series of reports and conversation guests we call Traveling Money, Managing Hawaii's Tourism Future. As part of that, we've been asking you for your thoughts about tourism, and our news director, Bill Dorman, is here with a midweek update. And, Bill, it seems as if there are a number of concerns surfacing about what's too much of a good thing, right?
No, exactly right. And just a reminder, by the way, that you can call and leave your comments on our talkback line, 792-8217, the number on that. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Yeah.
But those concerns about, yes, as you say, how much of a good thing. We've heard from a number of folks, and some of the thoughts similar to Annette, who called in from Kailua, with the idea that when it comes to visitors, how much is too much?
Aloha. My name is Annette Kaohelauli'i, and I'm calling from Kailua. I don't know if I'm going to be able to attend the tourism summit, but one of the questions that I think needs to be discussed is how many visitors can we tolerate before we destroy the resources? And there's nothing in the latest strategic plan for Hawaii Tourism Authority that even mentions carrying capacity. So I think those are serious issues, and there's a lot of people concerned about how many visitors we have, particularly on Oahu. So I think those are things that should be discussed. Mahalo.
So, you know, Annette uses a phrase that others talk about as well, this concept of carrying capacity.
Yeah.
And it is a concept that actually has been looked at, part of a report called Planning for Sustainable Tourism. This was done by DBED, Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism. Our thanks to Paul Brubaker of TZ Economics for pointing this out. It's a report that was published more than 11 years ago.
Yeah.
Work on this started more than 15 years ago. And it takes up the idea of carrying capacity and the difficulty of applying that to tourism. So it points out carrying capacity was developed as a wildlife management tool, how much livestock can fit in a
right.
certain area. And then in the 80s, they tried to apply this to environmentally sensitive areas.
Mm-hmm.
And this specifically looked at difficulties of applying that concept to tourism and three main reasons. One, areas in a region feel the pressures of visitor and resident growth differently. In Hawaii, even within individual counties, impacts of visitors and residents differ by location for different infrastructure and resource systems. Also, a lot of the pressures that build up on infrastructure, roads, beaches, et cetera, are mm-hmm. from population growth as a whole, not just visitors. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And third, very few hard constraints on visitor activity. So negative impacts of increased visitor activity, it's gradual pressure. It's more sort of that, the frog in the slowly boiling water. and that as this capacity constraints, as these pressures move from what they say annoyance to intolerable, it's not only a judgment call, it's also a moving target.
And we move in graded steps from annoyed to intolerant.
It's true. And even the phrasing around this whole discussion is, you know, take the word capacity.
Yeah.
What is capacity? You know, we hear figures every month from the HTA Dooley reporting in terms of visitor spending and in terms of hotel capacity in different situations. And so that's an occupancy rate. And that's one measure But and a lot of times you will hear that given as well. There's room for more. There's room for more at the end. That's one measure, but that doesn't tell you about traffic on the road, hikers on the trail, and short-term vacation rentals. Those aren't even figured in terms of hotel occupancy. So that eye to the future has been of concern to another listener who called in. Kathy called in from Lahaina with this perspective.
Aloha, this is Kathy Corcoran calling from Lahaina on Maui. And I'd like to say that I think the tourist industry has been very irresponsible in promoting tourism because it's been promoted at the expense of the environment and at the expense of cultural traditions. It has brought too many people to Hawaii staying in vacation rentals instead of hotels. And that, of course, means there's less rooms, less residences available for the local people. Thank you. Aloha.
Now, to be clear, tourism is the biggest industry in the state. Mm-hmm. It's the biggest source of private capital there is for Hawaii. It's a huge source of tax revenue. No one is saying shut down the planes, you know, chase people away. But a lot of the focus here is on managing future growth.
Well, there's also, just to throw something else into the mix, Bill, we talked with Mike White, who's at once a general manager of a large resort and chair of the Maui County Council. And he spoke of, and this is something that has to be part of, I think, any discussion of the visitor industry, he spoke of the fragility of the visitor industry. And we've seen, you know, rapid, and other destinations have seen rapid downturns because of a sudden change in perception. You know, after the Gulf War, Japanese didn't want to come here because we were, you know, a nation at war, and the visitor industry struggled to you know, say, no, please, you know, you're welcome. It's not, you know, but in Japanese culture, it was respectful to stay away from a nation in perception of a nation in conflict. So, but, you know, that was an unforeseen byproduct of a far-off conflict. Really didn't affect Hawaii on the ground at all, but it rapidly and radically changed tourism for quite a while. We don't always see those things coming is the point I'm making.
That's true. There's an unpredictable nature to this. The World Tourism Organization, and actually World Bank and IMF, do a lot of work in the tourism area because they see this as a long-term economic growth. It makes sense if you think about it as economies become more mature, then the ability, Maslow's hierarchy, as you sort of move up there, it's not just about shelter and food. Oh, let me travel. Let me have, I have leisure time. I have more income. Growing middle class. And also more moneyed than that, because Hawaii is not a middle class destination in a lot of ways. It's a high end. It's an expensive ticket, and it's an expensive stay. But that idea, in terms of as economies grow, so does tourism globally. But then, what is Hawaii within that? Again, managing the future.
Well, you know, Hawaii, it is no longer a middle-class visitor destination, but a lot of its growth during its greatest period of growth came from exactly that, you know, that it was made into an affordable destination for the middle class when air travel, you know, began to come to the islands. It were, you know, certainly during the 70s and 80s, there were all these packages you could get with, you know, 2 weeks in a car and a place in Waikiki, and it, you know, a lot of effort was made into creating an affordable vacation destination.
Affordability, I think, relative, you know, updated information now. So $16.8 billion in spending this year, 9.2 million visitors. This is projected for 2017, which would be the sixth year in a row, records both categories. DBED says more growth in 2018. Projections, of course, notoriously difficult as you go out. But 19 and 20, they say still more growth, about 68% of that coming from domestic travel.
You have to go back to that what that first recorded caller said. You know, she has never heard carrying capacity addressed as part of our planning.
But it's interesting, too, because a lot of these concepts come up, and we have looked at this. We have put in this. This was done, but this report that I mentioned before from DBED, and we're going to put this up on our website because it's fascinating. It's 93 pages. But the 2001 legislature secured funds to begin looking how Hawaii can better monitor and manage future growth in tourism, the Sustainable Tourism Project. Just a couple of other items from that. Tourism continues to be the state's dominant industry. And as they say, given this dependence, the incomes of all Hawaii residents tied more or less to the visitor industry. That's that's interesting. But not necessarily all sectors grow with tourism. Agriculture in particular at that point is a plantation agriculture, but agriculture generally does not move up in lockstep with tourism. A lot of interesting points. We're going to come back, of course, to a lot of this. Paul Brubaker is going to be in on Friday, a chance for you, our listeners, to call in live on the program. Jeff Boland also is going to be on the line with us. He's the CEO of Sustainable Travel International, featured speaker this week at HTA's Global Tourism Summit. And in the meantime, if you want to give us a call, 792-8217. Love to hear your mana'o on tourism.
Yeah, it's good to. This is obviously a discussion that resonates with a great many people. So we'll look to see what people say when they call in. I hope we hear from some people. Thanks, Bill.
You bet.
Bill Dorman is HPR's news director.
You count on us to be responsive to news of the day, issues of concern to our community and to you, our listeners. We hear you. Starting this week, we're bringing back shows many of you have asked for, including On the Media on Mondays, Freakonomics on Tuesdays, and Left, Right, and Center on Fridays, all on HPR 1 at 7 p.m. Visit HawaiiPublicRadio.org for more about the exciting new lineup at the 7 o'clock hour.
In today's Backyard Quiz, it was the only recorded instance of a whale deliberately sinking a ship, and it made quite an impression on the young Herman Melville, turning away from a life at sea and determined to make his name as a writer. The story was irresistible. In November of 1820, an 85-foot sperm whale charged and sank a whaling vessel in what eyewitnesses described as a deliberate attack. Surviving crew members had no choice but to pile into three open boats and try for landfall. They were spotted and rescued by another whaling ship 93 days later. The first mate, Owen Chase, was one of the few survivors. He later wrote about his ordeal in The Narrative of the Most Extraordinary and Distressing Shipwreck of the Whale Ship Essex. His book was one of the inspirations for Melville's great novel, Moby Dick or the Whale. And that's the ship's name we were looking for, the Essex. Roy from Kaimuki was the first of several to call in and get that right. He was the winner for today's quiz. And if you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. The face of tourism is changing, as Manny Matos is learning at first hand. Manny is a woodcrafter who carves native Hawaiian weapons from local hardwoods. He's a visiting artisan at Waimea Valley, working under the auspices of the Valley's Napoe Hana Noi Au Visiting Artist Program. The program is funded by a grant from the Hawaii Tourism Association, and through it, Manny is meeting tourists hungry for a visitor experience that doesn't depend on sun, sand, and surf.
When I first became aware of the specific program, you know, visiting artists at the Waimea Valley, and I felt, well, I really don't want to do it, you know, but
really?
I was encouraged by my Olohi, Mitchell Eli, he's the Luapa Olohi. He said, "Manny, go. It's a very special place. It's a very religious place, you know."
Waimea Valley,
and you go, try it out. Learn, see what happens. So I applied, and I haven't been in that valley for 40-something years. You know, 1961, I jumped off the falls at a young 19-year-old. But I haven't been there for over 40 years. And when I drove into the valley, I was really, really surprised and, you know, really astonished of what I saw there. You know, it was so culturally Pono in a sense. It was such a very beautiful place to go and to just to listen and to learn.
It's kept its character then.
Oh, definitely it did. They have a beautiful staff. She's, you know, run by very, very competent people. That key is they're listening to the valley and they're hearing what the valley has to say, and
That's good to hear. You know, that isn't the usual perception of a tourist destination, right?
Yeah, it surprised me as a local born and raised here. That, you know, it's not what you expect as a tourist attraction. It's a cultural experience. In fact, I talked to a person yesterday, tourist. They were sitting at the falls, and she had tears in her eyes, and she said, you know, I smelt every flower walking up the valley. I feel like, you know, I hear things here that really mean something to me. And she had tears in her eyes. And I said, I hope the valley, you heard what the valley was saying to you. And I'm sure that you can learn from this valley. You know, it has so much spiritual things to offer.
You know what, Manny, what that speaks to is that there's a different type of experience that maybe the tourist is looking for. We associate tourism with kind of tacky entertainment and, you know, flash and trash, but this is something different, isn't it?
It is. For me, it is being locally born. It was definitely an experience for me and a learning experience. I'm learning a lot more than I realized I could learn, you know, especially from the short period of time I was there. And the tourists really feel that because I'm in Waikiki once a week, and you know, at a very old hotel doing my stuff, and they tell me over and over again they're looking for the essence of what Hawaiian means, what Hawaiian culture means, and they're hungry for that. You know, these tourists yesterday they feel it just by going into that, and they have no idea what's happening to them. You know.
Well, you know what, it sounds as if they're going to be going home with a visitor experience that is probably more memorable, that is going to last longer in their memory.
Oh, definitely.
Just having fun, right?
That valley has so much spiritual, I would say, the mana in that valley is so powerful. You know, just by the name of it, Kamana Nui, Kamana Iki, there's only one location on the island that's on the same level with Waimea. It's Mauna Loa Valley, Kamana Nui, Kamana Iki, you know. And they have, in my opinion, you know, the most spiritual offering that you can experience. And Waimea is really doing the right thing. The valley is really listening. The people working there are listening, and they're doing what they're hearing.
Manny, what's your role, you know, day to day? What do you do? You're a wood carver.
Yeah, I make Native Hawaiian war weapons.
Right.
Basically, I make them out of Kawila uihui, highly endangered species. And also, I make them out of koa wood, which I sell to people that are interested. But the pieces that I make out of Kawila uihui are just for cultural and educational purposes. And, you know, I found that talking to tourists, talking to even local people, that if you show them a piece of wood, you know, your span of attention is 30 seconds. But if I show them that same piece of wood that I have crafted into a leomano with shark teeth, even great white shark teeth, you know, their span of attention is as long as I would imagine. Yeah, you know, even in the classes when I take the weapons to the kids, you know, I hold their attention for an hour and a half easily.
Well, one of the things that you're exposing them to, both the students and the visitors, is the whole idea of craft, you know, that you can spend days carving a piece of wood, right? Craft that takes its time, kind of an older idea of craftsmanship.
Yeah, you know, and even me as a crafter, I'm dumbfounded by the skills of Native Hawaiian crafters, you know, with shaping and cutting these very dense, some of the densest woods in the world.
Yeah.
out of stone chisels, you know, and I use electric bandsaws and, you know, it breaks the blades and everything. But this Native Hawaiian crafters were so skilled just with stone chisels, and even the tourists cannot comprehend how these weapons were made, you know, and that's what I try to do, is I try to educate them about the culture that's Mara, as far as much as I know, and I'm still learning, especially from Waimea, and how difficult it was and how dedicated the Native Hawaiians and how skillful they were.
And how patient, man.
And yeah, patience, you know, patience is, I cannot believe the patience they must have had, you know. Yeah.
Well, that's what, you know, that's what craft is all about, but it takes a kind of reverence for your materials, and that's what I hear and what you're telling me about.
Well, yeah, you know, a lot of the tourists, what they see as an image before they get here is not really what they want to experience, because they're a lot more intelligent than we give them credit for. They know what they want to learn. They know what they want to see, and if you give them this cellophane or this synthetic, there's a place for that, but if you give them that, then they're not satisfied. If you expose them to the real true culture of being, what was it to be a Native Hawaiian? What was it to be born and raised on this island? You know, what was the early Hawaiians about? Then they appreciate it a lot more. They'll come back time and time again.
Manny, it looks as if the work you're doing now is the culmination of a lot of the years behind it in terms of the work that you've done throughout your life.
Well, it's been a learning process, but I think I'm accelerating my learning process more by being in Waimea Valley, because I didn't realize how important that place is, you know, and the learning aspect is for me, you know, learning. And you have a culture director there. She's such a brilliant girl. She is filled with the passion that I've never seen, you know, a Native Hawaiian girl in the things that she does. And she's educating me, you know, and I'm learning more from the Valley. I think that's the most important thing, is the Valley can teach you so much, so much, you know.
Manny Matos is a woodcrafter who carves Native Hawaiian weapons from local hardwoods. He's a visiting artisan at Waimea Valley, working under the auspices of the Valley's Napoe Hana Noe Ao Visiting Artist Program. The program is funded by a grant from the Hawaii Tourism Association.
No matter how you count, HPR has the music for all the times of your life.
I'm Sandy Tsukiyama of Brazilian Experience on HPR 1.
And I'm Gene Schuller, Classical Music Director on HPR 2.
We're here to ask for your support so that we can continue to bring you the local and national music programs you count on.
Please give early to our fall fund drive.
The HPR app makes it easy to call or donate online.
And thanks.
Time to look at what's going on around the state of Hawaii, and Morning Edition host Derek Malama is the man to talk to about such things. He joins us for a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. Today, if you're on Hawaii Island, there's an opportunity tomorrow on Hawaii Island to learn about the state of healthcare on that island.
Yes, the West Hawaii Forum welcomes health experts from the medical, government, and insurance sectors, and they'll discuss the problems and solutions to healthcare access for Big Island residents. You can learn how to navigate through the island's healthcare options and find out what the future may hold for Hawaii County residents and healthcare providers. This is happening in the West Hawaii Civic Center tomorrow from 6 to 8 p.m., and it's free.
of interest to a lot of people affected,
I would think.
Healthcare. Also, tomorrow in Kapolei, you can register to vote. It's time to start thinking about that.
Mm-hmm. The State Office of Elections will be hosting voter registration opportunities throughout this month, September. Tomorrow, staff will be at Kapolei Shopping Center to register voters and answer any questions. It's from noon to 7 p.m. tomorrow, and it's free.
And there's a free brown bag talk in Hilo. The Big Island is really jumping tomorrow, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Brown bag talk in Hilo on the power of positivity.
This month's brown bag speaker is Joan Schaefer. The topic is how to affect optimal performance for yourself and others. You can learn what positivity is if you don't know already, how it benefits you, and how to integrate it into your life professionally and personally. And this is happening from noon to 1 p.m. tomorrow in the prosecuting attorney's office in Hilo.
We're just going to have to think positive, aren't we, Derek?
I think so.
And there's a family pauhana at UH Manoa also tomorrow night.
Yes. You bring the keiki to this one. Uncle Wayne and the Howling Dog Band will perform. Food and beverages are available as well. This pauhana at UH Manoa is happening at Hemingway Hall tomorrow night from 5 to 7 p.m.
Howling Dog Band.
Yeah, I know. You like that name.
That's right. Yeah. Thanks very much, Derek.
Oh, you're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar. You can always find out more at our website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
On the eve of elections in Germany, the far right is flexing its muscles, pointing to refugees as a threat to the nation.
Islam does not belong to Germany, and it doesn't go together with our values.
And stirring memories of World War II.
We have not seen this type of discourse really since the Nazi Reich.
The politics of hate in Germany on the next Reveal.
This evening at 7.
And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, we'll catch up with Brian Ramos. We spoke with him last January before he entered the geodesic dome atop Mauna Loa. Now we'll hear how that research study went. As a reminder, we're no longer rebroadcasting The Conversation at 7 p.m. Tonight, we will air the program Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line, leaving your comments at 808-792-8217. Email is talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. And if you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook. We hope you join us tomorrow.